care. Maybe it was last week. I can't do these so far in advance. I forget. I did an interview with Robert B. Parker, so I taped the Spencer television show, Spencer for Hire, and I took a couple of excerpts.
It's funny. I met Parker because Parker won the Edgar the same year that I did, and I was a kid. I was 27 years old, and you know he's a tough character. And I panicked, and I'd read all his books. I guess he'd written about five at that point, and I liked him. He wasn't as well known as he is now. But I blanked out when I met him. We were both, you know, getting our little pluses. I said, "And I love your books," and I suddenly couldn't remember the detective. And he said, "You know, Spencer, like the poet," which is one of the lines he uses in a
couple of
books.
You could have said Fletch. You'd really have gotten yourself in trouble.
Well, McDonald was there too. McDonald had won the two previous years, one for Best First Mystery, and then he won a paperback, Best Paperback. So he was at the dinner, too.
This was some years ago. Did you go to the last dinner?
No. I haven't been recently.
I've been to the
last. It was a strange thing because I hadn't really thought that I was writing mysteries. I really hadn't thought that much about it. I sat down and I wrote a book, and I got a call from the Mystery Writers Association. It was a panic call, this woman, and she said, "Where have you been? We couldn't find you, da-da-da-da, and the dinner is going to be like two nights from then. Can you come?" And she was so nervous that I wouldn't be able to come, and I don't know how they had lost track of me, but they had, that she told me that I won before the dinner.
No wonder she wanted you to go.
I'll tell you, yeah, right. But, you know, the strange thing is, even knowing that I had won, I still went there, and I was petrified and nervous as hell. And I kept thinking about, I wonder what it's like. And I knew that I'd won, but I always was like, maybe she's kidding. Maybe this isn't the true situation somehow. And I wonder what it'd be like, to go to the Academy Awards or one of those things where you're really, and you don't know, and it seemed like it would be an awful situation, not a pleasant thing at all.
Well, I don't get petrified the way I used to, but I remember the worst interview I ever had in my life. Well, I've had a lot of bad interviews, but this was really awful. About 10, 12 years ago, I did an interview with Gore Vidal. And he may have been up late the night before. I don't know. He seemed very tired. Looked like he probably had a hangover. I don't know. But Gore came in, and he was promoting, I think it was a sequel to Myra Breckinridge called Myron. And at that time, I was doing a 30-minute FM broadcast that was syndicated. I was glad to do it, although they did. It was primarily the parts I did were primarily literary, and they aired it at 5:30 every Sunday morning on WCBS FM, rock and roll station. You know, so nobody heard that broadcast. But anyway, it was still a forum, and he came in, and we did it upstairs in one of the studios up there. And there was a single technician, and there was just me, and there was just Gore. I could see he was disappointed. I mean, I could see that he was expecting something much more than a simple radio broadcast. I mean, I know that he thought there should be a studio orchestra, an announcer, or a straight man at the least, you know, and a comedian maybe, and girls to take him around to getting coffee and all that. And there was just me, you know. And we, so, and he was very tired, and he began to yawn. And this one I had to have good timing. I mean, this was a 30-minute broadcast. 29:50, I had to make it come out right on the nose. So I'd ask him a question, and he would throw it back at me. Every time I asked him a question, he would throw it back. I would say, "Now, you have been quoted as saying that you are bisexual. Are you indeed bisexual or homosexual?" And he would say, "Well, aren't you?" That's the way that interview went, and it was terrible. And I mean, he really intimidated me to the degree that by the end of the broadcast, he'd virtually taken it over and signed it off. It was his. I destroyed that tape. I had to use it because they needed it for the following week, but I did destroy that tape. That happened to be the worst interview I ever did in my life. I know what it means to freeze up sometimes because that's exactly the way I was. So I swore I would never do another interview with Gore Vidal, but times change.
have you done
and,
it?
And I have not. I've had Gore back in, and I did not do the last interview with him myself. This was a couple of years ago. It was before Lincoln, his last big book. And I was producing a midday broadcast, And so I arranged for Gore to come back in and do an interview with him. I didn't want to do it myself. But when he came in, he was perfectly affable and friendly, and you would never have known that he was such a Grinch, which is what he was.
A nice word.
Yes. Well, I certainly enjoyed reading Black Market. It's a real page-turner, and it's gripping and exciting. It builds to a climax in the way that it's supposed to. You've left the door open for a little more, potentially, at the end. I don't know if you intended that to be the case, but there's always that possibility that I won't divulge who, but one of the main characters in the book could come back and do some more work. Tell me now how you have been able to integrate your life as a creative director and vice president at J. Walter Thompson with that of a man who has been writing mysteries and thrillers.
In the beginning at Thompson, I think I needed to release something other than advertising to let myself loose creatively. So I would go home every night and sit in the kitchen at this time, and a little card table chair, and the counter was too high, really, and I'd be typing up around the level of my eyes. But I just needed a real, just someplace to let some stories out. I had originally done some fiction down at Vanderbilt.
Trouble Mater?
Yeah, I went to graduate school there, where they allowed me to write a master's thesis as fiction. That was the first one that they had allowed to do that since James Dickey, which tickled me, of course, because I think he's a terrific writer.
Now, what was your master's thesis about?
It was fiction.
You were able to write a piece of fiction, as
yes.
A novel, was it?
Yeah, it was a novel. When I was writing down there, it always seemed that it was presumptuous of me, however, to think that I could make a living writing fiction. So when I came to New York, I got another job and figured that would pay the electricity. And just because I like to write so much, I started writing, you know, and kept writing. And then the first book was the Thomas Berryman number, which was the one that won the Edgar. And we sent that around and got a nice reaction to it, and Little Brown picked it up and, you know, put it out.
Of course, as an advertising man, you probably have done a good deal of writing as part of your career, your other career.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, earlier in advertising, I did a lot of copywriting. Now I do more supervising, pretty much all the product that comes out of the New York office. And one of the things that the book writing has allowed me to do is to remove my ego out of advertising. A lot of advertising writers have that need to produce, to compete with their people. I don't have that because my ego can get off in the fiction area.
Well, it's interesting. You went to Vanderbilt, where James Dickey was able to write, I don't know what he wrote for his thesis. Was it also fiction?
I think it was poetry.
Well, whatever it was, but he was also an advertising man.
Yes, right.
And
he used to write Coca-Cola commercials.
That's right.
McCann-Air.
So I guess it hasn't really hurt, literarily, to be able to do something like that, or maybe it has.
I think it helps in some ways, especially commercial fiction. I think that in advertising, you are very quickly disabused of a lot of your ivory tower notions. You come in and everybody thinks that they can write advertising. So you come in and you're young and you write a commercial and they test it. And then you find out that nobody noticed it, nobody remembered it, nobody cared. And suddenly you start thinking, well, gee, I don't know everything. And you begin to get a little bit more in touch with what people like out in the world and what they want to hear about and things like that. So I think that has helped me in terms of writing, and this is really commercial fiction as opposed to
serious. Yeah, didn't I read, see, or hear some advertising executive criticize his own field by saying 90% of most advertising is ineffectual? Who was it? Delafield?
I don't know.
It
sounds like something Jerry would say.
Yeah.
It's someone well possible. Known. I don't think it's that high. But
Well, of course, we all know that advertising is effectual. If it weren't, I wouldn't be here today. So
right,
we need it.
No show.
what are you've worked on probably a lot of accounts. What are some of the accounts that you've had?
I work on or have worked on Burger King, the Aren't You Hungry, and then the Battle of the Burgers, Kodak, Miller Beer. Once I start on a list like this, it's always dangerous because I leave clients off in the Goodyear.
Well, you're working on these high-powered accounts. Then you go home and you suddenly find the tranquility of a solitary environment in which to write. Tell me about this contrast and how that has affected you.
Well, I just love to write, and my schedule now is I get up every morning between 5:30 and 6, and I will write till 8 or 8:30, and I've been doing this now for 9 or 10 years. Some people like to play tennis, and I like to write fiction, so it does release me. And when I was a kid, my grandfather used to run, drove a bread truck, and in the summers he'd take me to work with him. I was, you know, 6, 7 years old. And he had this terrible singing voice, but he used to go over the Storm King Mountains to work, and he'd be singing Oh Susanna or whatever was in his head. And he told me that he didn't care what I did when I grew up, whether I was a sanitation guy or the president, but that when I go to work in the morning, I should go over the mountain singing. And I do that. I get through with the fiction writing in the morning, and I generally go to work feeling terrific. And I like what I do in advertising, which is much maligned, but it shouldn't be because it's a lot more interesting than people think it is.
Gosh, you don't look like a singer.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't sing. I sing in my somewhere in the back of my head. My grandfather didn't either. But,
Now, Black Market. In the dedication, on the dedication page, you write, "For anyone who's ever dreamed about some small and delicious revenge against money changers on Wall Street and around the world." Well, this sounds almost like a threat. What is the motivation behind this dedication?
Well, I'll tell you, I was sitting in a bar in New York with another friend of mine, and we were talking about some unpleasant experiences that we'd had with Wall Street brokerage firms and whatever. And I had this idea of a little, fantasy idea about what fun it would be to blow up Wall Street. And the book came from there. There was a movie, actually came from a book called Compromising Positions. The movie came out about last year at some point. And a character in that movie, a dentist is murdered. And a character comments on it later on and says, "Yeah, I always wanted to kill a dentist myself." I think a lot of people have some need to do something to the people that handle our money, either bureaucrats or people that don't seem to care so much. So that's what stimulated this thing.
So you got even in some
respect. Yeah, I got even.
Well, what did they ever do to you?
Oh, they didn't make me the $1 million I needed somehow, even though they promised that they would. So
listen, advertising promises a lot, too, and never delivers.
This is true. Forced me into fiction writing to make some money. So that was part of it. This kind of book, I enjoy this kind of book, and I had read a lot of them, and it, one of the important things with a commercial thriller is to have that good what-if hook. So that's the other thing we started with here. What if somebody came in and took over Wall Street or bombed Wall Street? What would happen? What would be the effects? I did a fair amount of research, sat around for a couple of evenings with some New York City policemen and a couple of people from Wall Street, and we really mapped out a realistic scenario in terms of how this could and would happen and what would be the result of it. As it turned out, the scenario that we dreamt up, we all felt was a little too realistic, and I am still a practicing capitalist, so we decided not to put it into the book. No use making it any easier for people who might want to blow up Wall Street. And in point of fact, the policeman who I spoke to talked about a number of times when they have uncovered, not necessarily at the same level of the plot that's that drives the action in Black Market, but various plots to attack buildings on Wall Street. So there is some realism behind the book.
Well, there certainly is historical tradition to blowing up Wall Street. I mean, it goes back to practically the turn of the century and right up until the early 80s, I think. They were still planting bombs, terrorists or whoever, planting bombs, the FALN,
people
like that.
If you
like
put yourself down there, and I did get down there a number of times just to kind of get in the mood. I mean, one of the things that I'll, when I'm writing a book, I will scribble on the top of manuscript pages, be there. So if I feel it when I'm writing it, and if I can see it, then maybe the reader will be able to see it and feel it and be there too. And I did go down there a number of times. And if you walk around down there, especially if you walk around either one of two times, either rush hour or on a weekend when nobody's around, and you really there's just something ominous about that place. There's something epic. There's something. It's a kind of a location that you wish that Hitchcock could have, you know, done a movie down there. There's just something about it that
it's out of scale.
Yeah.
You've got these huge buildings on these tiny, narrow, winding streets. It doesn't work.
There's nothing like it anywhere in the world. It's just it's a very spooky area.
It is, and it's and the streets are dark because of this. If you go to Houston, Texas, a place where my family lives, and so I go down to visit frequently, it's loaded with skyscrapers, beautiful, monstrous skyscrapers, but you always see them from a distance. And New York, you have to look almost straight up to get an appreciation of a skyscraper. There are some beautiful buildings in New York, but you really can't appreciate them. They're all congested, and then Wall Street is even worse. So, and this darkness does create an eerie feeling.
Well, then when you wander down here and you think of, and you begin to conjure up the scene, if somebody actually came in and blew up some of these buildings, I mean, it really is extraordinary to think about. I mean, visually, it's...
Well, of course, that was an attention getter. The plot thickens, and there are layers of subterfuge throughout, and we are never sure until toward the end who is responsible for all of these things. So it's a rather complex book. You must have planned this pretty efficiently before you began writing.
Yeah. Well, I will always start with a pretty complicated outline. I usually change it a lot before I, you know, arrive at my final draft. A lot of times what will happen is as I start to write about a character, I get more and more interested in that character. And in the case, in this book, the anti-hero or the villain, I began to get a lot more interested in this character, Hudson, and he became more and more important as I wrote more of the book. And I found that I didn't want him to get maybe his just desserts at the end. So what happens at the end of the twists at the end have to do with my own affection for this character.
But that's
not the way I started the book.
Yeah, he was the best character. There's no doubt about that. Well, the other thing you did, you certainly covered New York City. I mean, I think you hit almost all the boroughs. Well, I don't think you hit Staten Island, did you? Well, you went to New Jersey, so that was almost the same thing.
Right.
I think almost everything is set in New York except for the one scene in Paris.
There's a scene in Ireland.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you covered the city pretty well and staking out the location, so it's a city you know pretty well. So this was probably a natural thing for you to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I live here, so... Mm-hmm.
Who are some of the other people that you read? Did you take turn a page from some of the other writers to give you the impetus to write Black Market?
Some of the people I like Thomas Harris.
I don't know familiar with him.
He wrote Black Sunday.
That was the one about the balloon. I mean, the blimp down there.
Right, and Red Dragon. I like Forsythe, at least the early Forsythe. Mm-hmm. I like Robert Parker, who we spoke about before. I liked Ludlum until the last three or four books, or early Ludlum, and they all have different gifts. you know, Parker is terrific with character and dialogue. Also, George Higgins, also from the Boston area, who's wonderful with dialogue. And Ludlum has, I don't know what Ludlum does. He does something strange that's interesting. Nobody writes the way he writes, and some people poo-poo it and criticize it. But he invented something. He created something that nobody else...
Well, he invented plots that nobody's been able to figure out.
Uh-huh. Well, he does that, right? But he also, there's something pounding about his action, so he does something well. This book, to me, at least what I wanted to accomplish, a little bit of The Day the Jackal Comes to Wall Street, that kind of... some of the excitement that I felt reading that book, which was a wonder. I would like to write one that good someday. Maybe I will.
Well, you finished Black Market. You've had two other books to your credit. What's it like as you go to work and face your colleagues and they know that you are now a novelist?
Yeah, they're used to this. Actually, I've written five novels.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Initially...
all published?
Yeah.
But they're not listed here.
Yeah, well, that's the publisher's...
Not a quirk.
It was just a mistake.
Uh-huh. Or were these the books that Simon & Schuster had published?
No. They put three in there instead of five.
Well, you're only allowed three.
The claim to fame of one of them, the Jericho Commandment, was that there were 10 books banned at the Moscow Book Fair, and they were all wonderful books, except possibly the Jericho Commandment, but they banned Animal House and
Animal Farm.
Animal Farm.
Yeah.
1984 and the Jericho Commandment, which I had written. So that was a claim to fame for that book, which they don't mention in there.
That's good. It's good they banned it. You know, otherwise they would have just stolen it anyway.
Right.
You wouldn't have gotten paid for it no matter what.
Although apparently now they are beginning to a little bit of royalties from the Soviet Union. I read recently. But at work, when I first started writing there, I think people found it a little threatening. Gee, is he giving his all to advertising?
Are you?
Yeah. I'm driven to do things as well as I can do them. I try to do an honest job, whatever it is. In the case of the book, I wanted to write a book that would be an entertainment that people would put down and go, gee, I'm glad I read that. That was exciting. That was fun. It's not John le Carré. It's not a work of art, but I think it is on the level of some of the faster pace. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make, because I don't think there's enough decent escape fare for adults. Movies now, 90% of them are for teenagers. Television, it's awfully hard to find something on television. So books remain one of the last refuges. And there are a lot of really terrific books to read. Lately, I haven't found that many thrillers that really grab me. So what I wanted to do was write one of those that if I was a reader, I'd go, gee, that was great. That was a nice 5-6 hours.
To fill the void. And people who like thrillers and like, as you pointed out, escapist literature, I think will like... Black Market, because it's certainly it's easy to read, it's literate and it's simple to read, and it's a page turner. So I think it's a good addition for the genre. So James Patterson, thank you very much for coming in and telling me about the book and filling me in about your life. And incidentally, I should ask you, where are you from?
Originally from Newburgh, New York, and then Lexington, Massachusetts.
How did you get down south?
Vanderbilt. I had a fellowship.
To Vanderbilt?
Yeah.
Where'd you go to undergraduate school?
Manhattan College.
Manhattan College?
Yeah. It's in New York City.
Is that a four-year college?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a Christian Brothers.
Oh.
It's up near.
Oh,
Florida.
I got it confused with the City University.
Manhattan,
I think they have a college. I think it's called the same name.
There's a Manhattan Community. I don't know.
Yeah. That's probably what it is. That's probably what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
What did you study when you went to college?
English.
And what were your career goals at that point?
You know, I don't really know if I had any terrific career goals then.
Usually people who major in English don't.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of that's how a,
or
a lot of fairly bright people wind up in advertising for that reason. A lot of philosophers and artists and English majors and people who didn't sit down and go, you know what, I want to be an accountant. I think part of it had to do, I knew I didn't want to be an accountant, and I knew that I didn't want to be a lawyer, and I'm a little too squeamish, strangely enough, even though I write thrillers, to be a doctor. And I knew I didn't want to be an engineer. So, and once again, I didn't, as I said before, I didn't feel, I did feel it was presumptuous to think that I could make a living as a writer.
I don't know why. Just many people do.
Yeah, they do.
And they turn out material that is certainly inferior of what you've written.
Well, I hope that's right. I mean, I could, at this stage of the game, I could make a living writing, but I don't want to at this point. It's a funny thing. I always had in the back of my head, I was in advertising, and I said, well, you know, if I ever really hit a book, I'll get out of this. And the book before this did very well, sold to the movies, and there was a big paperback sale, and it sold to 3 book clubs. And I was shooting some commercials out in the West Coast, and I got a lot of this information. There was a very big English sale, and all of a sudden I made a lot of money. And instead of feeling this tremendous excitement, I got depressed. And it took me a couple of days to get over this. And finally I said, you know, and what I was depressed about was it was kind of put up or shut up time. And when I finally said to myself, you know what, you like what you're doing now. You like this dual career thing. And you don't have to stop, you know, living this way. You just continue doing it until you don't want to do it again. And now you have the money. If you don't want to do advertising, that you can, you know, take off. But that was a revelation to me.
Well, you know, that's an interesting story. Clive Irving was an advertising man. His last book was called, I had it right.
Kessler?
I think it's Irving.
Kessler?
Kessler.
Yeah.
Clive Kessler. There's also a Clive Irving. I think he's an English writer. Kessler, his last book was called Cyclops.
Yeah.
And he has created kind of a James Bond hero.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was an advertising man in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think Gerald Brown, I think, also. The
well, Kessler just
Stone,
quit. He bought a house, a trailer or something, and he left his advertising job. And he said, I've saved up enough money, sold the house, and we're going to drive around mm-hmm. and then find a place to sit. And he did that. He wound up in Colorado. He's living in Denver now, but he had to go back to work. He couldn't sell those early books. They were all sold out of sequence. He wrote 2 or 3 of these books and couldn't sell them. I think the 3rd or 4th he was able to sell. And then mm-hmm. since that was a hit, that was called, I think that was
Race
called
Titanic,
Raising
right?
the Titanic.
Yeah, yeah.
He was able to pull the other ones and sell them.
I'm amazed that he could, not being able to sell the first couple, that he would keep writing Dirk Pitt stories, that he wouldn't have said, okay, well, that didn't work, I'll try something else. But apparently he believed enough in the character to keep writing
every book. But he had trouble. He had to go back to work for an advertising agency, and then he got fired. And in Denver, you don't have that much option. So he went back to writing again, and he did it. I mean, he's got a big antique car collection.
Yeah, a lot of times, I think firing can be a terrific thing for a lot of people. It's not right for you. It's not right for them. And you know that. I think that a lot of times that becomes a way for people to really.
That's endemic in advertising, isn't it? Firing?
Not the way people. Once again, it's a very misunderstood field. As I mentioned to you before, you wind up with an awful lot of ex-philosophy majors and English majors, and basically pretty nice people. And my own philosophy, this actually, there are a couple of people before me who have felt this way. I will only hire one kind of person in advertising, and that's someone who is talented enough to do advertising that people remember and notice, and also nice to get along with. And that's one of the reasons that I don't want to leave the business. I love the people where I work. You know, I have the benefit of being able to hire them, but they're wonderful. They're great people.
Stan Freberg really had a heyday at your expense, not your personal expense, but the expense of the advertising industry back in the, remember back in the 60s when he came out with those records? The savaged advertising.
Yeah.
He had his own agency, too.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, for years, advertising has deserved all of the criticism that it got. It was just, you look at the advertising here, say in the 70s, versus the advertising in Britain, which is very entertaining and wonderful, at least a lot of it is. And the advertising here for a long time really was crummy, very condescending, boring, awful. Lately, it's getting better. Not that all of it is good, but some of it is as entertaining as, or more entertaining than other things on television. So it's
You know, I was watching the 4th of July. This shows you how bad I am, or how bad advertising is. I don't know. I don't know which. Probably me. But there was one commercial that was just marvelous, and I think it was a beer commercial. It showed the Statue of Liberty, and it had some music that sounded like it might have been Copeland. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then it showed, a matter of fact, it looked like a teaser by the network.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw this.
Yeah, I did.
And I think
just
it was
a competitor, so I'm not going to mention.
Was it a beer commercial?
Yeah.
It was a beer commercial. I can't remember the name of the beer commercial even. But which shows you that either the spot was too good to have reached me with the name of the product,
mm-hmm.
Because I was overwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was such a beautiful thing, and they ran it frequently, and it only ran in like 12 seconds or 15 seconds, something like that. It
mm-hmm.
was really, or maybe 20 seconds. It was, can't remember how they line them up on television anymore. I've kind of lost track, but it was a wonderful, wonderful spot. But why can't I remember the name of the beer?
Well,
was the spot too good? So I focused all my attention on...
That tends not to be terrific advertising. Sometimes you'll see spot, and you do know. I mean, ideally, you should at least remember the product. That's not good advertising if you don't remember the product. It may have been a good entertainment.
Crazy Eddie, you always remember. I mean, it's the worst advertising I can imagine, and yet people remember it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the guy's doing his work for them.
Yeah, but there's good stuff that people remember. You know, people, you know, Bartles and James, I think people enjoy, and they know what it is, and... Yeah, so there's a lot of good advertising.
Well, I have to confess for you, I can't remember which fast food place had the advertising, where's the beef, and everybody picked that up.
Mm-hmm. And that's another competitor.
Was it Wendy's? Was one Arby's or one of these?
Yeah.
I can't remember which one it is. Now that's terrible. If maybe advertising, this is really not part of the literary interview, but if advertising is not reaching me somehow because I can't remember the product,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it's just... middle-aged senility that is...
Now it's just you're like a lot of people. And that's, you know, that's all fair and good. It that hopefully will make for better and better advertising as more... And people are becoming a lot more selective. Little zap stuff that, you know, if they don't want it, get out of my life. I don't have time for
this. What are these... You know, the economic situation as regarding the television industry... is changing. I mean, the audience is flattened out, and it has with radio, too. The AM radio audience has dropped substantially, and there's a larger share. I noticed the top five radio stations in New York City are FM rock and roll stations. The top three adult stations or talk stations are on the AM dial. That includes WCBS. It's always been in that rank. I mean, we've always been among the top three of that I've been here. The top three adult talk or news stations. But now we've got ahead of us these rock and roll stations.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever listen to them, the disc jockeys are promoting discos and queens and little local spots.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas our station does airline spots and banks and so forth. So obviously demographically, we're reaching the people we are supposed to reach. But there is still a change in the way the audience is made up. And the audience is going to probably constantly dwindle at some point. We know it is.
Mm-hmm.
The scale is showing us that both for radio and television.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many other options, videotape, cable television, these other things.
Mm-hmm.
So how is the advertising industry reacting to these changes? And certainly newspapers have changed. Magazines have changed. Here's the Daily News, desperate now that Gimbel's is folded.
Yeah.
So what's happening here?
I imagine that what will happen is if cable ever becomes a dominant medium, advertising will make it so attractive that advertising will become a part of cable, something like that. You're already seeing, you know, ads in movie theaters and yeah. But the other thing is that people will demand that it become more and more entertaining. As I said, the English stuff is can be very charming and wonderful to watch.
Well,
and that's because
I guess
people demand it, and they won't if it isn't. They just...
Well, if I heard you correctly, I think what you were saying is that it really doesn't matter to the advertising industry what happens in terms of newspapers, magazines, television, or radio. Your industry is going to be able to adapt to whatever changes
develop. Well, it's not that it doesn't matter.
We
won't have any choice, so it will adapt and evolve. And, you know, it always has. I mean, it's, you know, obviously television wasn't as important as it is now. Print was the dominant medium for a long time. Isn't as much anymore. So.
Well, thank you, James Patterson. Incidentally, speaking of advertising, I was driving through Brooklyn a few years ago, and it was one of the worst slums that I'd ever seen. Terrible, terrible slum. Burned out buildings and vacant lots and garbage. Oh, it's terrible. And I looked up on the side of a building. It was a huge billboard, and it said, WCBS, News Radio 88.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what? What? There is nobody within miles who would listen to our station here and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world could they have, somebody really got a screwing on that, putting that billboard up in the middle of a slum for CBS?
Yeah,
it was incredible.
Yeah. Now that happens every once in a while. It's like the book company sending authors out to talk shows in St. Louis, and there are no books out there. You know, all the businesses.
Yeah, well, the publishing industry is pretty archaic. It hasn't lived up to expectations.
Which is really, really unfortunate. I forget complaining, because I don't care. I mean, I care, but I don't care that much. Books remain, at this stage of the game, I think the best entertainment, the best means of getting information available to us right now, in my opinion. It's the most sophisticated form we have.
It's more than that. Books usually, I don't know what printing you had for Black Market, but most significant books, and I'm speaking primarily of scholarly books, are, you know, very serious literature. They have very small printing.
Mm-hmm.
They might have a printing anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 or 5,000,
mm-hmm.
7,000 copies. That's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
We have that many people living in my apartment complex in Manhattan.
Yeah.
But what happens is the book is very significant. It has a great amount of influence, which far exceeds the number of people who read the book, because it has an impact that almost no other medium has, I think. So... The book, even though it is archaic in many respects, because you have to physically market it and
mm-hmm.
carry it and send it out to warehouses
mm-hmm.
and deliver it, so it's not a very efficient means of communication, it is still, in my estimation, probably the most powerful
mm-hmm.
because people listen to
mm-hmm.
books.
Yeah, but the thing is, here is this wonderful treasure, books, and we're not making use of it, and it's not being marketed to books aren't being marketed so that people know what's available, know what they might like. I mean, again and again and again, I will meet people who don't read that much and say, what do you like? And I suggest a book, and they go, oh, that was wonderful. I love that. Do you know any other books? People just don't know what to, and then they walk into a bookstore, and there's so many titles, they're threatened by it, they don't know. I mean, other than people that really are bookaholics,
well,
as I am.
No, well, I don't know. Whose fault is that? There are plenty of avenues for people to find out what is being written and who is writing.
It's people's fault, but it doesn't matter. If you're selling something, you've got to figure out a way to get it to people and to turn people on, to get them excited again. And unfortunately, the book industry, I think, needs some kind of a genius, one person in one of the book companies that really figures out, as you know, 2015, whatever it was, somebody figured out paperbacks, and here's a way to really reach a lot more people. Somebody needs to do that again right now and get people interested in reading again, widen that audience, because that audience keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Well, I don't know about that. I was reading a survey in Publishers Weekly that showed that the book buying audience is bigger than ever in history. And part of the reason for that, according to this survey, it was very detailed, had pie charts and all
mm-hmm.
that stuff, but the paperback explosion that developed after 1939, like 38, when they were first introduced here in the form that we now know it, led to that. And when they were only a quarter, you buy them for a quarter. When I was a kid, you buy them for a quarter. I still have some of them. This just brought, and you could buy them in a drugstore, supermarket rack. And that just brought books to people that, you know, books were intimidating for many people. I believe, if my facts are correct, in the late 1930s, in all of the United States, there were only 500 bookstores. There are thousands of bookstores today.
Yeah, no, there certainly are a lot more books.
Of course, there are a lot more people today, too. But still, I have a feeling that...
Yeah, I wonder what the statistics now are now on libraries and use of libraries and, you know...